So I got to briefly qualify. My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. So I drank a lot when I was younger, and I drank a lot more when I got older. And that was really pretty much the story. I could not stop drinking. I started out trying to moderate when I was in high school, and really I was just trying to hide the fear and self-centeredness and the little child that I had inside me that didn't want to be around people, and alcohol was the only way I could do it because I needed to feel accepted and wanted by other people, and alcohol seemed to make me feel better about myself. When I got into college, I kept drinking. I started to do other things, and when I got out of college, I somehow managed to graduate and get a job and still be functional. And probably the worst thing I heard was people kept telling me I was a functional alcoholic. You know, so I felt I was doing okay if I could function, right? But the reality was my life was falling apart. I got married as an alcoholic, and I was slowly deteriorating that, and then finally, one day, I decided I was going to do something about it. And for me, I probably spent 8 months going in and out of AA, not really seriously, just listening, thinking I might get sober. But finally, one day, I said I had enough. And it wasn't just enough to say it. I had it followed by some action. And I checked myself into a treatment facility, and really, from the moment that I said I had enough and I got on my knees and I asked God to help me, I didn't have that obsession to drink again. So I found a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm happy to be here. It's a privilege and an honor to chair this meeting tonight. So I'd like to have Sheila come up and introduce the speaker.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sheila. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 7th, 2007, and this is my home group. And I want to say welcome to everybody today, and especially to the newcomers. We're really glad you're here. And it's an honor and a privilege to be the talker stalker for this group. And my time is winding down. I don't have, you know, much time left, a couple of months. So, you know, I know a lot of people, and so I always pray and ask about the speaker. And this time, it actually got down to putting names in a hat. And, you know, this guy's name came up two times. Katie's always got to do two out of three. You know, that's just her. You know, so he came out two times. I'm like, okay. And I've heard his story, and, you know, it just touches me every time. And, you know, he shares from the heart. And I know he's very grateful, and I'm so glad that Evan has said yes to come share his experience, strength, and hope with us today. Here's Evan.
Hi, guys. I'm Evan, and I'm an alcoholic. By God's grace and program recovery and good sponsorship and just you guys, I'm alive and sober today, and I'm happy to be here. I hate doing this, if I'm honest. I always get nervous, and I still care way too much what people think about me, but I got on my knees before I came up here, and I asked God, you know, to talk through me today, and so if I end up doing anything crazy, it's not my fault. Gosh, where to start? Let's see, I'm 27 years old, and I got sober when I was 22. So if there's any newcomers in here tonight that are young, it can be done. I just had to be willing, and I had to hit a bottom that was hard enough and strong enough. And it wasn't just a physical bottom, it was an emotional bottom, a mental bottom, and a spiritual bottom. And I haven't chose or had the need to have a drink in a little over 5 years, and that's a miracle for me. I'm from Miami, Florida. I have a twin brother, and we were born to two parents that were lawyers, so I know how to argue and manipulate very well. I've been doing it my whole life. And my parents, they didn't come from money, but they had money, So they gave us a great childhood. By the age of 11, I had seen the world. I'd been to Europe several times, all over America. We had everything we could possibly ask for, the treehouse and the fort and the, you know, the power wheels. I don't know if you guys ever had the power wheels, like the plug-in ones. And it was awesome, man. I had a great childhood. And when I was three, it was like my first memory. I remember it was Christmas morning, and I went to the Christmas tree, and I saw these D batteries. And I don't know what it was about them, but I had to have them, so I stole them. And I hid them under my bed and lied about it for like 2 weeks. And I remember like my parents and my grandmother and everybody asking me about these batteries, and they knew I had them. They were just like seeing how long I would carry out the lie. And I remember the attention that I got from that, you know. And it was great. I loved the attention. And I was like, all right, I do this and I'll get love. Throughout our childhood, my brother and I were very close. We were also very competitive. It's like having a shadow that like talks back to you, you know. And when I was 11, we invented this game where, and this is so freaking alcoholic. By the way, if I cuss, I'm going to do my best not to. One or two might slip out. And I might mention dry goods. It's part of my story, but I won't get too far into it. And I also forgot to thank Sheila and everyone for asking me to do this. I appreciate it. Thank you, Katie and Sheila, and everyone at the Jaywalkers group, and everyone that came to visit. So, anyways, we're 11 years old, and we invented this game where we would be in the front yard at night, and we would pretend to fight, and we would wait for cars to come, and we would look like it was someone beating me up, and it was like me, my brother, and a bunch of our friends. And then they would run as the car got there, and I would pretend to be all injured. And then I would ask them for money to get a cab or to go to the hospital. I was like, no, don't take me. Just, you know, give me some money. And it worked. It worked for a while. And we made a killing. And I was 11 years old. And, well, it's funny, but one day, as I'm lying there in the street pretending to be hurt, I guess a drunk driver came around the corner and he didn't see me. So he hit me. And I remember feeling the car just hit here, and I just remember it felt like an explosion went off in my body. And what it was my pelvis and my tailbone had shattered. And I had 6 fractures in my pelvis, 5 in my tailbone. I rolled up on the windshield, he slammed on his brakes, I flew 25 feet, I landed on my face. It ripped this whole half of my face off. I had to have plastic reconstructive surgery. They had to use my brother's, twin brother's face to graft skin back onto my face and do it properly. I guess they did a good job. thank you. my ego's still getting down. But, it, you know, the teeth, knocked my teeth out. And I remember lying there, just like rolling on in the street, you know, and I had a concept of God. I was raised in a pretty religious family, but I didn't have a relationship. And I remember just praying to whatever was out there and asking for it to be a dream. I was like, "This, please don't let this be real. Let it be a dream." And I woke up in the hospital, and I woke up with an IV in my arm, with connected to something other than alcohol, which was my first taste of a narcotic. I won't name it by name, but it rhymes with schmorphine. And I remember I had this button that I could hit, and every time I was in pain, I would get some more of this amazing feeling that went through my veins. And my friends would come over, and we'd play, you know, video games, I should probably tell you, my mother is an elected official down in Miami. I won't tell you who she is, but so this was like front page news. This was Channel 7, Channel 10, Channel 6, you know, such and such a son hit by a car, and I got baskets from everybody, attention, letters, cards, postcards. Some guy gave me a car, like some billionaire gave me like a Ferrari, and my mom was like, no, we can't accept this. I'm like, damn you. I learned that I get attention. This is how I can get attention, man. This is great. And even though I was in a wheelchair. So anyways, I hit middle school, and now my twin brother and I, we weren't twins anymore, because I, you know, had been hit by a car and I'm in a wheelchair. So he's like the cuter twin getting all the attention, and I'm the kid in a wheelchair. And that sucks, man. You know, I can laugh about it today and make jokes about it, but it's, imagine being in middle school, man. That's effing hard, dude. You know, that sucks. That's a bad place to be. But I use it to my advantage. Look at me, look at me, look at me. Attention, attention, attention. I could, if I wanted to skip a class, I would just, I bumped into a wall. I don't have to take the test today. And the teachers would be like, fine, you don't have to take the test. So anyways, I'll fast forward. Eventually I recover, and now we're 14. And we get out of middle school, and my parents, I should go back real quick. When we were 8, Hurricane Andrew hit and destroyed our house, and I got a room with, there was a closet, and I learned how to isolate at a young age. That comes important later. But anyways, so we're 14, and our parents want to send us to Spain to learn Spanish. Well, I don't know if you guys have ever been to Spain, but there's no, drinking age there, and they don't really care. I mean, I had, braces and a mushroom cut. You guys remember, the mushroom cut? And I could go up to the bar and just get whatever I wanted. So in the 6 weeks I was there, I didn't learn any Spanish. But what I learned was how to drink, and I learned how to get women, and I learned how to do things other than drugs. And I learned how to lie and cheat and steal even more, because that's kind of what they do, the kids my age in Spain. I mean, we would break into liquor stores, and we would go around with these biker gangs that were there, and there was just no rules. It was just total anarchy. And it was great. I loved it. And I remember my first drunk. It was whiskey, and it was in this little bottle, and it was covered in Spanish writing, and it was just awful. It was just the worst quality whiskey you could ever imagine. But I remember how it made me feel, and it just lit me up, and it gave me a cape, and it gave, it just added to my invincibility and my superhero mentality, and it was great. The problem with the camp was, though, they didn't have much food, and I ended up losing 30 pounds, and I was kind of chubby from the wheelchair, and then I kind of hit puberty while I was there, so when I came back, my parents didn't even recognize me. And we get off the plane, and our mom walks right past us, and I tug on her shoulder, and her face went white, and she started crying, because we had lost, so we were emaciated, And she takes us to Publix, she gives us each a shopping cart, and she's like, go nuts. She's like, fill it with whatever you want. And, but now we hit high school, and I got accepted to a school called Mast Academy. Mast Academy is a magnet school on Key Biscayne, and it's beautiful, fantastic. Sand volleyball court, Olympic-sized swimming pool, crew team, right on the ocean. It's unbelievable. And but it was a whole new group of people, and nobody knew the wheelchair kid with no teeth from middle school. Now it was the taller, thinner, better-looking twin, and I got to reinvent myself. And that's what I did. I was my brother got all the attention, my brother got to be all this my whole life, now it's my turn. And I did that. And I got hooked up with the seniors real quick. I learned who sold the best stuff, who had the best stuff. And I made it my job to be that guy. If you needed things other than alcohol, if you wanted to party, if you wanted to know where the party was at, that was my goal, to be that guy. And I did that very well for a while. I kept my grades up. I was a punk, man. I wore those big JNCO jeans. I know you guys know what I'm talking about. Don't judge. I know you know. When I was 16, I'll fast forward a little bit now. My parents, who just had an amazing relationship, we were that cookie cutter, perfect, those annoying Christmas card families, they got a divorce. And the reason they got a divorce was because I found out through a friend of mine that my dad had taken a trip to Paris with his secretary, who he ended up kissing on the plane. And the reason I know this is because my friend was on that plane, and she told me about it. And I confronted my dad, and I said, you have 2 weeks. You either tell mom or I do. And 2 weeks to the date, I come home, and there they are in the living room. They're both crying, and they say, we're getting a divorce. Again, I'm 16 years old, right? Puberty is in full-fledged emotions, hormones, and it's all over the news. Again, because this is media down there. So, Channel 7, Channel 10. Imagine going to the high school, and you're sitting there looking at your teachers, and they're reading a newspaper, and your photo and your name is right there on the front, man. I mean, I can't tell you what that was like. It was great and it was bad at the same time. But I didn't care. I didn't care what kind of attention I got, just as long as I got that attention, because I was so empty. I was so hollow inside, and I didn't know why. Today I know that I believe I was born with alcoholic tendencies, and then through my use and through the things that I did, I developed alcoholism. And it talks about in the book how there is that point of no return, and I did reach that point of no return at a very young age. And I'm very grateful for that, because I was able to hit my bottom so quickly and so fast in life and be able to get this program of recovery, which is just, I mean, it's better than anything else on the planet as far as I'm concerned. But anyways, so they get a divorce, and now it's party time. And I rebel, of course, and decide to break into the high school with a bunch of my friends and just steal a bunch of stuff. We just stole speakers and TVs and computers and, like, you know, spray paint, and just kind of just boys being boys. I know that's not normal boys being boys, but that's my justification today anyways. Boys being boys, yeah, we just robbed a liquor store. But no, we were so drunk that I left my car at the scene. And the cops came, and of course they ran my plates, and they found out who I was. And so my buddies and I, we just bailed, and we just, like, whatever, we're caught, we know tomorrow we're going to jail, let's just have, you know, like, a great night tonight. And we did. Went to Denny's, and so, yeah, party time. We were there, like, six more. Anyways, the next day I come home, and, like, all this media is at my house. They're just, like, waiting for me. And my dad's standing there with my lawyer by the front door, and I walk up to him, and I just put my hands like this, and the cops put the cuffs on me, and I go to jail, and that was my first felony. I say first because I had two more after that. Anyways, you'd think that would be, like, a good sign to maybe stop, but it wasn't. It just fed to it. And now I went from, and I'll speed up a little bit, I went from the Mass Academy, which was 500 kids, good kids, magnet school, to public school system, which was 3,500 kids, and we had metal detectors and barbed wire, because it was Miami, and it was, like, in the hood. And I learned real quick how to, you know, just add gasoline to the fire that was my alcoholism. And now I'm that new kid who's all over the news. Talk about, like, legend in your own mind, man. I mean, I showed up and it was like, yeah, that's that kid, da 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 da, and it just fed to this insanity and this ego of mine, which is a little smaller today, just a little bit. But I get to Palmetto, and now my dad's out of the picture. My mom works, like, 18-hour days, and my dad was, like, the enforcer in the house. My mom is as strict as she is in the public eye. She's a puppy dog at home. And my brother and I took so much advantage of that woman and put her through hell. I mean, we put her through hell. She has a problem as well, and she did things other than alcohol when my father left to medicate herself. And my brother and I saw that as an opportunity to party. So she would come home and self-medicate, you know, a couple bottles of wine, go upstairs, pop some things, and we would just throw parties constantly. I mean, I remember we had a keg on our roof for, like, 3 months one time. People would just come and we'd fill it, and it was just a constant party. Somehow I graduate, and I get accepted to FSU, which I don't know if any of you guys have been to Tallahassee before, but not much to do there. It's like you drink and you go to class, and you don't go to class and you drink. And so anyways, I go to FSU. My parents buy me this apartment, you know, like, off campus, and it's like, you know, I'm free. And I remember I flunked out, and I lied about being there. So for a whole year, I was telling my parents I'm in class and I'm doing these things, and it was just a straight-up 24/7 party. And I remember this is when I started really getting heavy into the things other than alcohol. I mean, really heavy. We're talking for, you know, didn't leave my room for 2-3 weeks at a time, and would throw parties at my house that would go for days. And I remember this one night, I used to, when I would black out, I'm a blackout drinker, and I would fight things. Not people, I was too scared to fight people. I'd fight things, inanimate objects. Like, if I was drunk and I saw this, I would just beat the crap out of it for no reason. And there was, like, this glass front window of this house, and just for no reason one night, I just put my foot through it. And I remember, I mean, not all of you can see it, but I have this huge scar that goes all the way around my leg because I put my foot through this glass and, like, I fell into it. Well, anyways, the cops come, and I don't remember this, but my buddy that was with me, like, replayed the story for me. He told me that I tried to fight the cop as he was, like tying my leg up. And I'm like, oh, you're a pussy. Excuse my language. You're, you know, F you. And he takes me to the hospital, and I try to fight the doctor that's stitching my leg. I'm like, I don't need stitches. Kiss my, you know what, you know, and just, like, and I don't remember any of it. I mean, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, to the fullest, man. I mean, and I know that I'm an alcoholic without alcohol. Alcohol is but a symptom. But, man, does that stuff turn on my character defects. I mean, it just takes it. I mean, the alcohol has an effect on me that I just cannot explain. I don't understand it. I don't get it. I I'm grateful that I don't have to get it. I don't have to figure it out because I have a solution, which I'll get to in a second. So I come back from FSU, obviously, flunk out, and my parents are just fed up at this point. They're like, you know, what are we going to do with you? So my dad is getting remarried to this woman, and he's like, well, I have this extra condo in West Palm Beach. Why don't I just give it to you? Just start all over. Geographical. That'll fix it. Let's just get you away from Miami. We'll get you away from your friends. Go to West Palm. So here I am, like 20 years old, with my own condo, no school, no job, and I get a bartending job on Clematis Street. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Clematis. So my whole life was literally just wake up, get drunk, party, go back to sleep, pass out, wake up, party. And I did this for a year of my life. I must have driven in blackouts, I don't know, every night. At least 3-4 times a week. And you know, today I know that I had, you know, divine providence. Today I know that there was a hand of a force that is just infinite love and infinite mercy that was just keeping me alive, just would not let me go, because I'm not that lucky. I am not that lucky, man. Anyways, so one more story, and then I'll get sober here in a second. Two more stories. So one night I'm driving, and it was after Hurricane Charlie. I don't know if you guys remember that. And it had knocked down these street signs. And I come, and I'm driving, and I'm in a blackout, and there's fog everywhere. Or maybe it was just in my mind. I don't know. There's probably no fog. But the road I'm driving on comes to a stop, and I can only go left or right. Well, I go straight. And there's a fence and a playground behind that fence for school. And it's 6:30 in the morning. So school is starting pretty soon. And I remember my friend who was sitting in the passenger seat, and we're not wearing seatbelts, and he starts screaming like the top of his lungs. And I don't even notice. I've just driven through a fence. I turn the wheel, and the front left wheel hits one of those like slides, you know, those like curly slides. And we just whoop, 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 whoop. We land, and nothing happens to us. The car is smashed. The glass is everywhere. We walked. We climbed out of the back of the Jeep without a scratch on us. Nothing. And you'd think we would stop, but we didn't. We grabbed the funnel and the beer from the back, and we walked to his house and continued drinking. Just left my car there. Well, I get a phone call from the city the next day apologizing because the street sign was down, and they were asking me not to sue the city because I had crashed. And I'm like, just feeding to that invincibility. Are you serious? I got away with it again. And finally I move out of West Palm, and they did. They fixed my car, they towed it, they did everything, and, you know, gave me a settlement. It was great. So anyways, I come back to Miami, and now I'm getting to my last drunk. I'm living with between my mom and my dad. My mom and my dad, they're kicking me out. And then finally, neither of them wanted me, so I was at that Jeep that I told you about. I just lived out of it for a while. I would just get my clothes and wash them wherever I could and go shower. You know those showers at, like, apartment complex pools that they have? You know, the ones that are, like, yeah, that was my shower for a while. And meanwhile, you know, my mom has a $3 million house on the ocean, and I'm living out of a Jeep. It should have been a good sign to stop, but it wasn't. And at this point, I'm using women just to, you know, stay at their houses and just, you know, had like three or four girlfriends, just whoever would take me in and give me money and let me drive their car and all the other stuff I could get and manipulate out of women. And then I remember my last drunk. It was Tuesday night, and I was at my friend's house, and it was just like any other night, and we were, you know, playing like Madden and drinking, and I had done a lot of dry goods that night, and then I couldn't go to sleep because all the dry goods I did, so I took another kind of dry good that knocks you out, the other kind, you guys think that you know what I'm talking about, and apparently I woke up in my blackout, like at like 6 or 7 o'clock, like I was sleeping on the couch, I woke up fully dressed, and I walked 3 miles to a gas station, right? I didn't want gas, I don't know why I was going there, but I get there, and I have like, it's so funny, because I saw on the video, there was 3 cars. It was like a Jaguar, a red minivan, and a BMW, and for some reason, I chose the red minivan, and I wanted it. I don't know why I wanted it, I just wanted it, and I was like, that's going to be mine. So I get into the minivan, and I mean, talk about, you know, the hand of providence here, the hood is open, right? And the guy that owns the gas station also owns the minivan, is fixing the starter to the minivan. He's there under the hood fixing it. And I'm opening it and I'm getting in, and he looks around and he's like, "What the hell are you doing?" And I'm like, "I got this, man. I got it. Don't worry." And I'm like in a blackout telling him, like, "No, it's cool. I got this. He's like, "What are you doing?" So he goes inside, and I don't think it's any coincidence his name was Angel. I think it's really cool because he saved my life. He called the cops. The cops come. Apparently, I gave up trying to start it because the starter was broken. So they find me like fully reclined, passed out in the car. I didn't even try to get away. I was just like, "This is where I'm gonna sleep." And you know, they put me in cuffs. I fight them. Apparently, I'm like bleeding from my forehead because I'm like banging my head on the glass, and I have like my shoulders like really screwed up. So I come to, and I'm in this hospital bed. I'm chained to the hospital bed. I'm like, "What is going on?" And then I pass out again. And then the next thing I know, I wake up, and I'm on the couch in my lawyer's office, right? And I get on the phone, and I'm frantic. I don't know where I am, what day it is, what time it is. There's no windows. I don't know if it's daytime, nighttime, you know, what's going on. I don't know if I'm dreaming. And I call my mom. She doesn't pick up. I call my lawyer. And then I don't remember if I turned the TV on at the lawyer's house or if it was at my girlfriend's house. But one of the two, I turned on the television, right? And there I am on the Channel 7 news, and I'm watching myself. And apparently they had a camera in the jail cell that I was in, and they filmed it. And I was just in a blackout, like stumbling like this, flicking off the camera, spitting, punching the wall, and I didn't remember any of it. And for the first time in my life, I mean, I had been scared before, and I had, you know, had the incomprehensible demoralization, but this was enough, man. And I got on my knees, and I broke down crying, and I was like, "God, if you exist, this has to stop. Please, I can't take this anymore. I can't do this anymore." You know, I had had enough. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Apparently, the lawyer worked it out with the judge. They could clearly see I was intoxicated on the video. And they got me to a treatment center in Ocala. And I passed out again, and I came to, and I'm in a van. We're going along this dusty road in the middle of Ocklawaha Forest. All right, it's in Ocala. And they saved my life, man. So I get there, and I'm the pretty boy from Miami, and like I was like, "Shit, this is better than jail." And I had been defeated, but that ego was still there a lot. And I when I got there, they said, "All right, make a list of all the things you want to do while you're here." And it was get a tan, meet women, ride the horses that you guys have, and write some music, right? And nowhere on it did it mention sobriety at all. So I'm there for like a month, and I just did everything I wasn't supposed to do except for drink. So one thing I didn't do was drink or drug. I did everything else. I hooked up with the women. I skipped meetings. I lied. I manipulated. And then we did this thing called breathwork, which is like a Native American ritual where you do like this, transcendental meditation. And that was where I first was contacted by my higher power. And I had this profound, to this day, I can't really explain it. Science can't explain it. Experience where I had this whole visual journey where I was this phoenix and I was being raised from the ashes of hell and I was being pulled out by this angel. And I'm going to share this with you, and if you guys think I'm crazy, then good, because you are too. But when we were done with the meditation, we all had to journal about it. And we all went off and journaled. And I remember after journaling, we went to like the bench where everybody smokes the cigarettes. And me and these two other girls, we swapped journals to read what each other wrote. And I was baffled by this. And today, still to this day, I'm baffled by it. And it can't be anything other than God to me. The girl to my left, when I saw my meditation, I was a phoenix. There was a girl to my left that I was pulling out of hell, and an angel that was pulling me. So it was like the three of us together, right? The girl to my left saw the same thing, but from the point of view of the girl in hell. And we hadn't spoken. I hadn't talked about it. And she wrote, I was in hell, and a phoenix was pulling me out, and there was an angel with the phoenix. And then the girl to my right said the same thing from the point of view of the angel. I was an angel, and I saw a phoenix, and he was pulling a girl out of hell. And the three of us are just looking at each other, and I still get chills to this day because that doesn't make sense. And if you go to that treatment center today, there's a huge wall by the volleyball court, and it's a 50-foot mural of this. Because even the counselors were baffled. They're like, what? You know? And to me, that is just proof that there's some power out there that I don't understand, that I can't comprehend, that no matter how much I try to analyze it and get into religion or dogma or this and that and the other thing, there's a force out there that's benevolent, that loves me and loves all of us, and that wants me to help other people with that story. And that's why I'm here today. And that's the greatest gift I could possibly ask for, you know? So, I hate crying. Anyways, I get out of the treatment center, and I move. They're like, a geographical doesn't cure it, but in your case, it's really going to help. We need to get you out of Miami. That place is just horrible for you. So I did. I moved to Orlando, Florida. And all I had was a car and a keyboard. And I started my life here. And my life from day one has just gotten exponentially better than I could possibly explain to you guys. Since I moved here, I started a traveling martial arts business where I would go and I would teach kids martial arts. I forgot to mention, from the age of four, I've done karate and piano. Those are like my two passions. I love martial arts and I love music. And today, I get to do the things that I love to do that I was too scared to do before, that I was too trapped in this, I gotta look good and sound good and make other people like me, to really be true to myself and be who I am today, you know, to embrace the person that I believe I was born to be. You know, I think when we become alcoholics, there's a point in our childhood where, you know, we want to be astronauts, or we want to be the president, or whatever we want to be, and then somewhere along the way we give up on those dreams and we settle and we say, well, you know, that was silly, let me just do this. And I'm here to tell you, man, it's not silly. You know, like, if you have dreams, and I know they say bring your dreams to AA and you'll sell yourself short, and that's true, but if you have like that passion, that desire for something in your life, go get it, man. And if you stay sober, you can have it. Because since I moved here, I had a band, I've toured, I opened up for Three Dog Night at the 12-Step Music Fest, I've been on television, I've been on radio, I've sold thousands of copies of a CD that I wrote and produced and mixed and edited and put my blood, sweat, and tears into it, and I did it all sober. I can get on a stage today and I can perform and sing songs that I've written from my heart that through my higher power I've written, and I get to do that. You know, I get to be there for that. And that's incredible, man. I mean, I was born again. I don't know how else to explain it other than the old self died, and now here's the new self. It's crazy, man. It's so powerful. God, there's so much I wanted to say, and I'm like forgetting all of it now, which I guess is good because it means it's not from ego. But anyways, I'll go through the steps real quick then because I can't think of what else to say. After the first three steps, which I think I did that day on the floor in my lawyer's office, if you're new, you know, the only step you have to work perfectly, I was told, is the first step, man. Just admit that you're powerless over alcohol, dash, your life has become unmanageable. Because if I was honest with myself, that was clearly the case. I mean, and so it wasn't hard for me to do that. A power greater than ourselves. You know, I struggle with religion. I still do to this day. But this isn't a religious program. It's a spiritual program. And it deals with principles that are common to every religion, man. And there's so much beauty that we can take from religion and so many things that we can get from people that have been before us. And if we can just not be prejudiced for 1 minute and just try to listen with our hearts about what people are honestly saying about God. And that's what my experience has been. That over time, my image of what my higher power was has changed. It's changed many times. But I believe it's the same God, you know. I believe the wheel on the spokes concept, where the wheel is God. And I can choose any spoke I want. And no one's better or worse than any other spoke, but it's all in the same wheel. We're all going in the same place, you know. And all Alcoholics Anonymous asks you to do is pick a spoke. Pick a spoke that makes sense to you. You know, whatever that may be, find something that you believe can care about you, you know, because in step three, we have to believe that he cares about us. And, you know, I remember my counselor telling me, because I thought God hated me. He told me about all the times I was in a blackout, all the times I almost died and should have died and could have died. He goes, "What the hell do you think was keeping you alive that whole time, man?" Mm-hmm. You know, and that hit me like a ton of bricks. It was like, you know, and I've said this in meetings before, if I go to Vegas and I shoot craps over and over and over again, I'm not going to win 1,000 times in a row. I'm just not going to. I'm not that lucky. Nobody is. But that was my drinking. There is absolutely no reason why I should be standing in front of you here today. I should have been dead many, many, many times over, and I'm not. And I believe that's for a benevolent reason, so that I can come up here today and share my story. And even if only one person gets some help from that and identifies and says, "Oh man, I was like that too, and I did my job," you know. Step four, guys, if you're dreading this step, man, it will set you free, brothers. It will set you free. Because I carried that crap with me for way longer than any person should. And the fifth step that I did, I've done several, but the first one I did was on poster boards in front of six people in my treatment center. So if I can do that, you can do it in front of one person, all right? And then, you know, defects of character, man, God, that's a lifelong process. You know, I don't get rendered white as snow. None of us do. And that's something that I will grow with my entire life, and I'm glad of that, because the onion layers keep peeling and keep peeling. When I was 1 year sober, I knew that I was there. And then when I was 2 years, I was like, God, I was an idiot at 1 year. And in 3 years, I was like, what was I thinking in 2 years? And now I'm in 5 years, and I don't know shit, man. I'm just like, I hope that I don't want to know. I don't want to arrive. I don't want to think that I've gotten it, that I've been to that place where I can't grow anymore. I don't want my cup to be full. I keep pouring it out, and I keep pouring it out, and I keep pouring it out, and I keep learning, and I keep growing. And today, it's a lot easier than it was when I first started, man. When I first started, I would sit in those defects for days, weeks at a time. You know, the resentments just, you know, it talks about in the book how it blocks us off from the sunlight. And that to me is hell. You know, I don't know what your guys' concept is, and I don't mean to step on anyone's beliefs, but hell for me is just separation from that force. Separation from that higher power that loves me. That's hell to me. When I feel like I'm alone. When I feel like I'm running the show and I have nothing helping me and nobody guiding me. That to me is the worst place to be in the world. And I've gotten there in my sobriety, and that sucks, man. That's shitty to be sober and to feel that loneliness. And when that happens, I got to go back to basics. I got to go back to where it all started. I got to go back to meetings. I got to get back in my sponsorship. I got to go out and I got to help others. This is just willingness right here. You know, the how of AA is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. If you have those three things, it says that in the book, you can't go wrong. But you got to have this kind of honesty. It's not just me telling you, hey, I did this or I did that. You got to be honest with yourself. Be able to look in that mirror and not shave like this. You know, you got to be able to look at yourself and be like, yeah, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm not doing. And then own that, you know. And then ask God to remove it. That's the thing I always forget. And a friend of mine in here reminded me of that the other day. That's simple. Just God, remove this from me. You know, and if I have to ask 50 times, 100 times, remove it. But then I got to take the action behind it. I can't just ask God to remove it. Hey, God, don't let me be an a-hole anymore, and then be an a-hole. I have to take the action behind it. You know, find the asset that's behind the character defect. I was told that all of my defects are hiding assets. Everything that I didn't like about myself, everything that was bad about myself, was just covering up an asset that God had put there in the first place. And when I ask Him to remove that defect, there's that asset. And that's awesome, man. You know, because if we hadn't, I'll speak for myself, if I hadn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sure I would have had an okay life. You know, not really, but I'm sure that eventually one day maybe I would have either landed in prison or died or ended up whatever, and a lot of us would have, but I never would have found this way of life, and I never would have found who I am today. And that's what this program does. It's so much more than not just drinking. And if right here you're just like, how do I not drink? That's awesome. Stay there. Don't let me overwhelm you. But the rest of the steps, man, they teach you how to live. And that's what I want today is, how do I live life happy, joyous, and free without drugs and alcohol? And that's what this program does. This list was massive for me, and it still is. I'm still making amends today. But I'm willing to do them, and I do them when I can. 10, 11, 12, people call them the maintenance steps. I don't like that. I call them the growth steps, because I'm not here to maintain. If I was maintaining, I wouldn't be growing. And I don't know about you guys, but I only have two speeds, forward and back. That's it. I don't have sideways. So if I'm not getting better, I'm getting worse. So these steps allow me to take that inventory. You know, and I don't do it. Listen, guys, I am not the spokesperson for AA. I definitely do not do everything that I know I'm supposed to do. But I don't drink or drug no matter what. That's what this boils down to. At the end of the day, no matter what, my A falls off, whatever happens. And trust me, a lot has happened since I've been sober. I lost my grandmother to cancer. I lost my aunt to cancer. I was in a two and a half year relationship. Thought I was going to marry this girl, and she just left me out of nowhere to go to Costa Rica. You know, things have happened. And life is not a bowl of cherries, but no matter what happens, I don't have to drink over it. And that's the difference today. You know, and I'm here to tell you guys, like, as long as you stay sober, things do get better. You know, if I look at my life like a stock from when I first got sober to now, it wasn't just a straight line up, okay? It's gone like this. But where I'm at now compared to where I was when I first got here is, I mean, it's exponential to the point where I can't even explain it. So I know I'm wrapping up here. Just a couple of things I want to say. There's a passage in the book. If you're struggling with spirituality, there's a passage that I love. It says the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. And that means we're all invited. Everybody. We can all tap into this power. No matter where you're from, what you've done, you know, what you've been through, we all get to experience that. And the other quote that I like in here is, just to the extent that I do what I think He would have me do, and humbly rely on Him, does He enable me to match calamity with serenity? And what that tells me is I have a conscience. I know what's right. I know what's wrong. If I don't do the next wrong thing, because sometimes I don't know what the next right thing is. Sometimes I don't know what to do next. But as long as I don't do the next wrong thing, chances are I'm okay. You know, calamity will happen. But if I'm living under the guidance of a higher power that I love today and I can trust today, I can match that calamity with serenity. And that is a beautiful thing. So thank you guys so much. I owe you my life. I can't tell you how grateful I am to Alcoholics Anonymous and to God. And thanks for letting me share.